Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hi, I'm Paco Romaine.
And I'm George Chen, and you're listening to SubDoc, a show where we talk to our interesting friends from the world of comedy, writing, TV, and film about their favorite documentaries. On today's episode, we celebrate the birthday of revered director Werner Herzog by discussing his 1999 documentary, My Best Fiend. Herzog made five films with the magnetic and volatile Klaus Kinski, some of the greatest work both men ever did. My Best Fiend explores how their personalities and egos drove them as artists. And we bring on our guest, Bucky Sinister, who counts this as one of his favorite films of all time. Bucky Sinister is a poet, comedian, and novelist who has appeared in the Bobcat Goldthwait movie Willow Creek and Hidden America with Jonah Ray, in addition to releasing comedy and poetry albums. He's at the Business at Little Joy every Monday in Los Angeles after a lengthy run in San Francisco. And now, our talk with Bucky Sinister. It's a pleasure on an early Tuesday morning to have Bucky Sinister
Hello.
Here in the house. Thanks for coming up. I guess I don't know what you're doing. I know you were just working as a PA. You were talking about that on stage.
That was a small temporary gig that I had that I exaggerate for comedic purposes. It was good. I did work on Moshe Kasher show.
Yeah.
Problematic.
Awesome.
Yeah. And it's really cool. And Moshe threw that at me. That was pretty cool. Thank you, Moshe. Moshe's given me a lot of stage time and gigs. It's funny. We haven't really like hung out that much, but he's always like, he's one of those guys that like we're not hanging out, but he's like, hey, come here and do this gig. Like I happened to be in Portland at the same time as him one time, and he's doing this really big show at this theater. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like when he was just first starting to sell places out. Mm. And he's like, hey, come do 20 minutes in front of me. I'm like, thank you. Like it's like, he's always been this kind of like this kind of gig elf that just kind of like, you know, just comes and gives me. So thank you again, Moshe. Oh, him. He was one of the first, when I started comedy, he was like one of the first three people I asked, like, what do you do to start?
And
it's one of the few times in my life I asked the right people for advice on anything.
Right.
Al Madrigal and W. Kamau Bell.
Yeah. Well, just to even get into like what I was saying, like you occupy a lot of different spaces. Like you've written a novel.
Yeah.
You've written kind of like memoir stuff about recovery stuff. Or?
I wrote four books of poems, two self-help books, and a novel.
Doing stand-up too,
and
you're getting ripped and you're in the gym every day.
Totally. I'm a competitive athlete. I compete in Russian kettlebell sport.
So you're lazy is what you're
totally. And
it's what we're getting
I compete several times a year. I've been competing twice a year lately. I'm probably gonna step that up. I want to start doing it three times a year if I can. I don't know. It's just my mind like spins a lot. I have a problem with that, and it's kind of like that's what quells it.
Yeah,
that's what brings it.
How
that's
are
what,
you on meth what, then?
Yeah. That's what quiets it. I mean, it's just like all my drug use. It was pretty much me trying to find an equilibrium and just trying to like find an answer for like. Mostly my mental and emotional states, like how do I regulate this stuff, like, you know, and drugs and alcohol to me were just buttons I could push, like if I feel this way I'll take this one, if I feel that way I'll take this one. And it was me self-medicating and trying to like, you know, just like it's like say, okay, this isn't right, there's something wrong with me, so I'll just take this. You know, like that's what that was. I'm gonna push too many more things, but I like also I was in I got these three film and TV gigs from San Francisco.
Right, you did Jonah Ray's show.
Yeah, the Jonah Ray Show, Hidden America, and I just recently was in Paint It Black, Amber Tamblyn's new film, and then I was also in Bobcat's Willow Creek.
Oh wow, film. Awesome.
And I was like, man, if I'm getting all this from the Bay, maybe I should move down there and see what happens. You know, that was another impetus too. It's like, because I kind of want to do a little bit more and just kind of get more around that. Yeah. And of course, like, you know, it won't happen just by coming here, but like, it'll make it more, I'm more available now if people want it. Like,
yeah. Well, and to talk about, you know, like artistic struggles and having a dream and all the stuff you have to do to get there. We have perhaps one of the best documentaries.
Oh, yes, the documentary.
Like,
yes.
The reason we're here.
The reason we're here. Sorry, I just, like, talked about
No, I mean,
all
we started
you.
We That's started fun. On
this
it.
This is how we do it on SupDoc. Yeah.
We like to tie it in. Like, if you have a personal connection.
Yeah.
So you brought to us My Best Fiend.
Yeah.
Werner Herzog.
Which has a German name, but I'm blanking.
Mein Liebe...
Oh, yeah.
Freund. Yeah.
Lean out here and get my phone.
Yeah, go ahead. But so you brought us this documentary, which, like, we've oddly enough only done one Werner Herzog doc on SupDoc, which is Lo and Behold.
That was nice. You guys just had that. I was like, oh, that's a nice coincidence.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, okay. One of the things about My Best Fiend, for one, it's like I watch this once a year. Mm-hmm. And this film makes me want to create.
Yeah.
It gets me excited about making art, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I can see this is the film that made me a Herzog fan, all right? Like, this is really the film. Like, this one comes out in 99, right?
Yeah,
99. And it's like this kind of mid-career, like Herzog, right? Okay, he kind of starts, he's doing a lot of these weird films. Like, Even Dwarf started small, where it's all made with little people.
Right.
And it's really kind of weird and slow. But it's full of these odd images. And then there's movies like Hearts of Glass, where he, like, hypnotizes everybody in the film except for the lead. And then, in reality, he hypnotized all his actors and stuff. Like, mm-hmm. He did all these things like that. That was his early things. Then he kind of makes his first masterpiece with Aguirre, The Wrath of God, mm-hmm. right? And that's like early 70s.
72,
that's like
72. Yeah.
So he is his thing, his career revolves on. From there, like, from Aguirre to Fitzcarraldo, right, which mm-hmm. is like early 80s, like comes out in 82, although he's making it in the 70s. Mm-hmm. That's kind of more of the art house phase or whatever. And like those are arguably his two biggest contributions to film. It's like Aguirre and Fitzcarraldo, and that's, you know, these other films are good, but those are his big masterpieces. He's kind of quiet for a while. And like, he makes other films, but nothing else has that impact. And My Best Fiend shows up, and it's the first film where we really see Herzog as a character, right? And mm-hmm. now he does it a lot. Yes. Now it's a standard thing because people want him to be in the they want to see him. People like love this idea. And before, we had no idea who he was, what he looked like, whatever. And, you know, I saw Fitzcarraldo, but Aguirre was my favorite. And I was just like, this is just like, to me, Aguirre reminded me of like these weird religious guys I'd grown up with who were just really kind of almost maniacs. And that I would have followed up that river, that I would have gone to find El Dorado with.
Yeah.
That even as a child, I idolized these men. And, you know, I was like, I know this guy. I know Aguirre and there's this thing, and then but I never gave a thought of who is Herzog and who really is Kinski. And mm-hmm. then this film is not just about Kinski,
no,
it's also about Herzog. You see who Herzog is, and you also mm-hmm. see that they're a tandem,
yeah,
that they're like this thing that like one kind of happens with the other, and it kind of starts that phase, this kind of self-aware phase of Herzog's career. That continues to this day, and that he kind of is part of his brand now.
Yeah.
Like, he won't make a document like even in like Grizzly Man, like he shows up in there quite a bit. Grizzly Man is probably his most accessible thing. And I usually tell people when to see a film of his, like, start with My Best Fiend or Grizzly Man. Here's why, and those are the two things. So I was kind of even debating on this thing, do I say I want to start with Grizzly Man? But this one definitely is close to my heart. Mm-hmm. This film.
And you watch it every year, you say.
Yeah, totally. And then there's the later Herzog where he like just becomes, after Grizzly Man, he tries to make a, you know, like around there, he's like trying to make more accessible things.
Right.
He does Rescue Dawn, which is a really good movie, but it was still not like resonating with a lot of people. But then he does
Nicolas Cage
too.
Movie. Yeah.
Nicolas Cage. And he does My Son, What Have You Done, which is a beautiful film. I love that one as well. And Michael Shannon and Willem Dafoe.
Okay.
You know, where I argue he has two Kinskis in that film instead of just one.
Yeah. And also Dafoe plays Nosferatu. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Is Michael Shannon
Nosferatu is played by Kinski.
I know. I'm saying like in
Shadow
there
of the Vampire.
Right. Like they both played that
character. But yeah. So this one is like kind of like, that's kind of like, if you watch My Best Fiend, you can see where a lot of this other stuff originates. And that's what I really like about it. And you also get to see that Kinski was full of madness. And if you don't know, anyone doesn't know, I'm just going to talk to him. Kinski was like, he's just, if you imagine if Andy Kaufman was like crossed with Zod from the Superman films, you know, just like this, like this thing, he's like from another planet.
Yeah.
And he's still like, he seems to hate everyone, but why is he performing for them? You know what I mean? He kind of, Kinski comes out of the war. He's like POW. And, you know, he goes back to Germany. And it's just ruined. It's blown to bits. There's rubble everywhere. There's no, all the factories have been literally bombed to smithereens. There's nothing to do. They're occupied, though. Germany's occupied. And there's a lot of soldiers in there looking for stuff to do. So this German theater and performance scene picks up. This cabaret scene, picks up where you can get work as an actor or a singer. You can't, you know, the machine factory is been blown up because they were making, you know,
ammunition.
They were making, like, you know, like jet planes or whatever that, you know, they were where they got, all that stuff got bombed. But, you know, so Kinski like is really good. He's got a great theatrical mind. He starts memorizing like and doing like one man shows of like Shakespeare and stuff like that. And just quoting like entire monologues and is apparently amazing at it when he works alone.
Right.
And but there's enough work for that, but he becomes quite famous at that. And then even at the beginning of My Best Fiend, you see him when he did as Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He had a whole Jesus thing, and that's, as far as I know, all we have of it is that scene.
Oh, wow.
Maybe someone else has a full thing of it somewhere else. But by that point, Kinski, they want to kind of see Kinski melt down, right? He's in this kind of thing where people kind of wanted to see G.G. Allen kill himself on stage.
Right. Or Charlie Sheen or something.
Oh, yeah. Charlie Sheen's a good example. Like maybe a little bit of Doug Stanhope where they just kind of want him to be a bit of a mess.
Yeah.
And it's like, let's hope Kinski like gets really angry at everyone and has a meltdown. Right. And it's like, so that's what people are going for. And, you know, and it's in, that's how the film opens.
Right.
Like, My Best Fiend opens with that. And there's also a little bit in the beginning about how Kinski and Herzog meet.
Yeah.
And which is the main thing. He writes about it in, if you read Conquest of the Useless, I think that's the name. I'm sorry, I only mixed a lot of these books up. Well, there's a book of interviews that were just used to be called Herzog and Herzog. And I think they renamed it and added some more in there. I think it's Conquest of the Useless. Although I hope I'm not getting that mixed up with his Fitzcarraldo journals. This is the thing. This is as deep as a hole you want to go. You can get to the Star Trek level fan because Herzog's released memoirs. Kinski has a memoir that's amazing.
All I Need Is Love.
Yeah.
They reference that.
All lies. All of it.
Okay.
But it's hilarious lies.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like Norm MacDonald's last memoir.
Oh, yeah. Like, very much like that. Yeah. But like just more like nihilistic.
Wow.
Because like, you know, he has this this description of the cockroaches in the house where he grew up. He's like, the cockroaches were the size of baby turtles.
Right.
And it's like, I love that image. They were not that big.
Yeah.
I know they weren't. I know how big a baby
turtle is. About that big, though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's just like,
I've seen roaches that big in his apartment.
What?
I've had water bugs.
L.A. roaches.
But I don't know. It's, the imagery's great. And it's like, you know, Kinski says that, like, all the, you know, he had an okay time as a POW because he was so beautiful that all the guards wanted to have sex with him, you know, and that's like his view of the world. It's like, everything was great for me because I'm gorgeous and just how well he is, you know, just at all these different parts of life, whatever.
Is he a POW in Russia? Like, he was a
German where was he
soldier?
Captured? That's a good question.
He was a German soldier? And he was a POW in Russia, or where?
Do you know? He was captured in
British
Britain.
Oh, he
British.
Was a POW in Britain.
Yeah.
Yeah, and all those chaps are like, oh, y'all striking, Mr. Kinski. That's so fucking nuts, man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So,
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
If you like a good murder mystery story, you'll love June's Journey, a free hidden object mobile game where Detective June Parker unravels the mystery of her sister's death. Travel back to the beautifully illustrated 20s, find clues, discover hidden objects, and watch the story unfold with new chapters released weekly. Put your detective skills to the test. Download June's Journey on Android or iOS, or play online via Facebook games.
It's like, I got it. Oh, hold on.
Yeah, like that opening scene is Herzog going through the old house. I was confused about that because, like, he made it sound like it was the house that he grew up in in Munich.
Yeah.
That all, I guess, later in life became like a boarding house, or I was confused by that part.
Well, okay. Well, like, you know, when the war is happening, you know, Herzog is a boy. He's got like a infant brother.
Okay.
And the bomb goes off in town, and this, window breaks, and Herzog's brother's crib is like filled with glass, and his mom, like rightfully so, freaks out, takes him off to live out in the country on the border of Switzerland, like in just this little like kind of log cabin where one of her, you know, relatives lives. So he lives there, kind of secluded from the world and the war. So after the war is over, his mom comes back to Germany, and so the three of them have to live in one room in that boarding house. And she's has a job as like a seamstress or something like that. She's trying to figure it out, but they're that poor of like, we all have to live in this one room in someone else's building. And Kinski is living there. So Herzog's probably about 13, 14, 15.
Uh-huh.
And Kinski's living in the attic.
And he's already been a movie star at that point? No, not at that point.
He's like been in movies and stuff, but he's making somewhat of a living as an actor, but he's also like whatever his mental illness was had progressed in his thing. He was like, Herzog said he was sleeping in a bed of leaves. He just had a pile of leaves up there in the attic, and he would sleep in that. And that's where they meet. And, you know, for several months they live there together. And there's even a scene in the movie where they talk about one of Kinski's tantrums. They sees his tantrum.
Right, yeah.
It's like he has his tantrum for 2 days in the bathroom and smashes everything in the bathroom so thoroughly you could sift it with a tennis racket.
Right.
And that's one of the things about, like, just he just was kind of, you know, just amazed at the force the man had. And it kind of talks about seeing him in movies and stuff as well. But, like, Kinski is always... Herzog's always been fascinated with chaos.
Yeah.
And there's a great thing in Grizzly Man where he says, you know, this, you know, where Timothy Treadwell's talking about the harmony in nature, and he goes, and he just starts talking over him. He goes, this is where Timothy and I disagree. Or Timothy, you think man lives in harmony with nature? I think that, you know, nature is trying to kill us. And he's like civilization is but a very thin sheet of ice over a black boiling cauldron of chaos. And it's something like that.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's just like this thing of like, you know, that's, Herzog loves these forces of nature. He loves like these rivers that just seem to kill everyone. Right. And it's like in many movies, and Rescue Dawn and My Son, and like all these things, like the rivers, like this big character that just like, oh, nature will just try to eliminate all of humanity. That's all it's there for, is just to get rid of us. We're a mistake. And it wants to get rid of us, so we'll stop messing with it. And, you know, and he sees Kinski as this equal and opposite force.
Okay.
Of like
yeah,
this,
I can see
this
that.
Chaos of humanity versus the chaos of nature.
Yeah.
And he's just going to like, can I just smash them together? And it's why it's just so, it's just so brilliant. It's like, and you see how mad Aguirre is, but how mad is the Amazon, right? The Amazon River. Like, who's going to win? Fitzcarraldo, he's got, like, Kinski has got to get this boat from one river to another, like, and it's just this thing he keeps going back to. So Kinski has this force, and since Kinski is gone, like, Herzog has tried to find his new Kinski.
Nicolas Cage is not it.
He's looked for Nicolas Cage, Michael Shannon, Willem Dafoe,
that's
Timothy
a close.
Treadwell, you know, and they're all amazing actors, but he's like never really found his new Kinski, right? And it's just like, that's what the kind of the fun is of watching some of these, even Christian Bale. Like, you know, you can see any of these.
Oh, yeah, the Christian Bale's like
you can
his tantrums.
Yeah, you can reimagine any of these roles with Kinski as the lead, any of these, and it's like, oh, you just, you can see
better.
It fit in these movies so well. Like, you know, so that's, that to me is just like, when you see this thing, it just kind of like,
right.
It almost helps you watch these other movies.
Well, there's certain director-actor combos that we always think of, right? There's like De Niro, Scorsese, you think of.
Yeah.
I mean, they sometimes match in its own weird. Like, it's weird that, like, now it's Scorsese and DiCaprio. Like, that's become the dyad.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like, you think of, like, even how it's appropriate, like, someone like Steven Soderbergh and George Clooney always work together. It's like they're both kind of like slick and urbane in a certain way. So I guess that matches. And this is just like a guy who is completely deadpan versus like the most histrionic person ever. And like they're so intertwined.
Yeah.
I get. Do you feel like you've had relationships? Because you're very much like everything you do is like a solo artist in a lot of ways. Do you have like anyone in your life where you're like tied together in that certain way creatively?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, okay. For one, like I said, when I came up in, as a fundamentalist, I mean, we were really extreme, and I did like street evangelism and that
like
kind of
Baptist?
Thing.
Like
Baptist? It's I'm not naming which thing it was, but it's I want to derail like your whole podcast type, but it, like my family joined a cult. We joined a cult when I was
your family.
In high school. Yeah.
Your family did.
We
okay.
just went and did this whole thing, and that's I don't want to like. It can easily derail a conversation if I say that to people.
Well, that
but
sort of relates like, to this in a way.
Yeah, we grew
it's
up
like
fundamentalists, like evangelists, like the Baptists. They were too liberal for us.
Uh-huh.
Like they were going to hell because they used piano in church, like that kind of thing. Yeah, and like we were just like really, but that wasn't enough for us. We went a level deeper and we got involved with this other group. And then at that point, for like about the next 3 years, I was out like street evangelizing and hanging out with all these people. And like the guy running that whole show was one of my Kinski's, where it was just like he's my Geary. Like I would have, I did a lot of things because he said so, and I would have done more. And, you know, I was just a kid. You know, I met him when I was 12. We joined up with him when I was like 14. And I was just like, this is it. And I was super into it. And
did he have those eyes? Did he have those like the same like?
Oh
like,
yeah,
crazy
eye. Yeah. And it's like I still don't want to say his name because I don't know who's like I'm just always afraid of somebody out there who's still like into this guy. So I did that for a couple of years, and it was just like, but you know, I met a lot of people at that time, like because we're out there, like I was out recruiting, like. all the Colts dropped their guys off at the same spots. That's the thing. It's just this that's hard funny. Thing. It's like, you know, so I would be.
It's my corner. You work that corner.
Well, that's we would get real upset about that because, you know, it's like too many guys at a bar hitting on the one woman who walks
right,
in.
Yeah.
And then she's like going, fuck this. She's out. She leaves.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, I'm out there like. This is like the mid-80s, so it's like...
Arkansas? No.
No, this is Boston.
Boston, okay.
So we're in these like kind of like a Boston Common, the combat zone, the malls, like whatever, and Harvard Square, like all these places just kind of around the T-stops, kind of getting people as they come off the T. And it's us. It's the it's like the Moonies, the Scientologists, like the Jehovah's Witnesses, this group called the Way International. And you know, the Nation of Islam was down there too, like with their bean pies and the final calls.
Yeah.
There was, and then there was like, they would even have like, there was these other kind of weird, like the
Jews
Moors.
For Jesus.
Well, like the Moors, like the Nuwabian Moors, who were like this, like kind of black people from outer space groups. It gets real deep. Like those are the ones, those are the big ones. And then there's always these new ones that just started. Oh, the Christians were big then,
you know,
and so they'd all, we'd all be down there at the same time. Like, and you kind of like learn to pick up on someone's body language and like go after them.
Yeah.
And be like, that guy's vulnerable. Boom, let's go get him. And it's like, whoever sees him first, it's like, back off. but I met all these other people from all these other groups. And like, I would see that there were all these kind of like, this was a thing. And we're all looking at each other going, oh, that guy's nuts. And
your guy's nuts. My guy's good.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. But so I kind of came up with that. And then, you know, I looked at that and, you know, I kind of found the punk scene, which was kind of cool, but it was still like, by the time I got to the Bay Area, it was a little bit predictable already.
Yeah.
Right? You know what I mean? And it was like you know, everyone in the punk scene had gone to Berkeley High together and like they'd known each other since they were 12. I was a new guy, whatever. But I found the poetry scene, and that's where like I had these guys. And like there was, in the poetry scene back then, I would go to all these readings. Like the poetry scene in late 80s, like 89, around there, was like different. And it was like more.
Well, the Beats were like a generation before. So you guys were like.
Oh, yeah. They
were like
gone.
You're like the new 90210 to those.
There was still
guys.
A bunch of guys hanging out in North Beach thinking they could be Beats.
Yeah,
that were just like didn't understand they missed it. Mm-hmm. Right. And it just like was not coming back. Mm-hmm. There was a bunch of guys in Haight who were like all the Rainbow Gathering poets.
And you were the Mission
guys? Right. But like the Diamond Dave was like friends with all them. Right.
Yeah,
but like his stuff. Right.
Yeah.
But like Diamond Dave walked between all groups. Like he was a man.
I forgot about Diamond Dave.
Diamond Dave was like cool with everyone.
Yeah.
And then there was like just these different cliques and factions all over San Francisco. But when you went and you read a poem, like you got heckled. Like people would like heckle your poems. It was kind of brutal. It was just like, you know, kind of rough. And at every reading I went to, there would be like one guy just immediately when he said his name, people would just like boo. People would yell at him. Like, and just like I saw Tom Stolmar get choked out at the Cafe Babar at 22nd and Guerrero one night, and I was like, "What is this place?" You know, be like shooting up in the bathrooms before they went on stage, and it was just like,
whoa.
It was just like this whole different
more
scene,
punk
right?
than punk, yeah.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Because these people were mentally ill; they had nothing else to do. They were not cool; like they did not look good. You know, the punks kind of were attractive. They kind of looked nice, you know. They were like hot people,
yeah.
Like you know,
skinny jeans and
Well, not them, but you know, that kind of idea. So, you know, all these readings. I had a chance to start a reading, and I was like, what if I started a reading with just these people who aren't welcome? What if I made the worst poetry reading in the world? And so I went to all those readings and invited all those people. That were just like people would just boo immediately, and I said, "Okay, I'm gonna book you as a feature in this new place. We're not gonna tell any other people about it. It's just gonna be like they were all in."
That sounds like mutiny.
Yeah. So I'm like, I'm gonna have the worst poetry reading in the world. Uh-huh. This is gonna be amazing.
Yeah,
like because I kind of want to see what would happen.
Yeah.
Right. But sort of like make a compilation of like all the weird outsider records.
Oh yeah. And you know, I had three guys who were homeless, not just like I'm crashing on a friend's couch. They were homeless that they'd come, and they just there was just, some of them were just so bananas that like you could not approach it. Like no matter how weird you're trying to be, it's like, oh no, that's where he lives. That's where his brain is.
Mm-hmm.
Once I kind of established like this is really your safe spot, like more and more of them started coming. Like just
wow,
like it was like a magnet, and then it was like a drain hole of
what was
like
the venue again.
There was the Chameleon, which is now
oh yeah, which
the
is
Amnesia.
Now the Kilowatt. Or right, 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 Amnesia. Right, yeah.
And you know when Karen bought that, people were like, "What are you doing? Why are you buying the Chatterbox? No right. one's going to go down to Valencia Street to drink." Wow. That was the idea because she owned the Night Break. She owned the Night Break up in the Upper Hay.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
that was the spot. You know, like L7 was playing there and everything. Like it yeah. was like super cool. And, you know, and then it's just like, what are you, why are you buying this
yeah.
horrible bar in the Mission? You know, that'll never work.
Yeah. And, no one's ever going to go to Valencia.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wow. And because the Chatterbox was this kind of like New York junkie, like this kind of like Johnny Thunders, like fucking junkie bar.
Yeah, they
right?
made like a book about it. There's
yeah,
like
yeah,
a photo
yeah.
book
yeah, yeah.
about,
it was
about
like,
that bar.
For all like everybody in there was a junkie from New York. Like that was just it was just crazy.
And that
there,
was
like,
the, what you, is now the Amnesia.
Amnesia yeah. yeah. So wow. like Karen bought it, turned it into the Chameleon, and it's like, you know, no one will come, and like, you know, why don't you have a poetry night here? I'm like, sure. So I get all these people in it, and pretty soon it's just full, and it's just like, just full of like those marginal personalities, really talented, really good writers, had like very few social skills, could yes. not get along, hate each other, just see them on stage. It was instant conflict, and people just wanted to go watch these yeah. people go. And it's like this thing, it's like those were my Kinskis.
Yeah.
I had a lot of them there, and just these, like, you know, not that talented, but yeah. just these like kind of brutal things, like just, you know, just these head cases, and you know, I'm gonna give you a microphone, you can say whatever you want.
Yeah.
And especially pre-internet era, that was a very powerful thing to do for people. And this other thing happened too, where a lot of women started coming to the things, not to read but just to yell at the men. And you know, because it was
that happened at the Chameleon a lot, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Where it's like, you know, we had women that would show up just to heckle the poets.
Oh, that's
not,
awesome.
Not to participate, just to heckle. But then I realized, like, oh, that is the participation. That is this thing. Because this is the first time they've had a venue to tell men to shut up, right? It's like right. this weird, like, this
wow.
guerrilla feminism of like, they would get upset when like the really like horribly misogynist poet didn't show up because they were ready for him.
Right.
They would come loaded to mm-hmm. yell shit at him, and it was just like, you know, just like, there was one guy we called him Devil James, you know, Captain Cowboy Devil James.
Everyone sounds like yeah, a justified
and,
character.
Yeah, totally. and he leaned into it. He leaned into it so hard of just like, I'm this horrible misogynist. And women love to just go there and just say the most horrible shit to him in public. And it was just like this freeing thing. And it was just all these things. So I started with the crowd, and then the audience turned into that too, where it's just like, we want to go and just to tell people to stick it up their ass. Like, we're tired of like these self-important, like San Francisco artists. Like, we're going to come there and just yell at them. So the place was a fucking zoo. And I loved it. I thought it was the best thing I'd
ever
done.
You're the ringleader.
Yeah. And I was the MC. And I did all the sound.
Curator.
Yeah. And
wow. You curated and weirdos.
Yeah, and we had fights there. We had fights break out because yeah. I was just inviting the worst people, and they would read poems about each other after a while. And that's when things would get real bad, and we'd have like straight fights like fist fights. And I had to start a
literary fight club.
Yeah. And it was kind of like, and I loved the chaos because I was in my 20s, and I was like, this is the most amazing thing that's ever happened. I remember this this giant woman. She picked up a bar stool and was like pulled it over her head to like hit someone with it. And as it was going back, I got there just in time to grab it from behind out of her hands.
Yeah.
And so she tries to swing forward, and there's nothing in her hands. She's just looking at her hands like it's disappeared. Like, she doesn't understand. And I was like, this is the best thing I've ever been a part of. Like, that was just, you know, I loved that so much. Like, like, you know, and just when, you know, like, this, we had, like, some of the Serenios just to come and watch. And
oh,
just
the
like,
gang guys?
Yeah. And they were just like, what is this? And like, they just, it was one guy thought it was real funny. Like, he loved it. And I'd let him up on stage once in a while.
Yeah.
But they were just like, when they came and saw what we were doing, that like, it was just like, we didn't know white people acted like this, basically. And he's like, you know, you ever need anything from us, let us know. We're, you know, like, you know.
Like, the Chameleon was a Sereno bar, is what you're saying.
Yeah, well, it kind of was at that point. Uh-huh. Like 20th Street was always neutral, right?
Yeah.
Like, and 19th Street was where Sereno territory stopped, right? Mm-hmm. So we were between 19th and 20th, but they were like, they would the hang out at that park across the street.
Oh, yeah.
It was like their territory. Soccer, definitely. Yeah. That was like kind of the last mark on there. And they fought for years over 20th and 21st Street. A lot of people died up there. There was like people got shot at the payphones that were all over there. The payphones all got ripped out, like because the city just ripped out the payphones because, you know, back then you would have to post up by a payphone and wait.
Yeah.
And you know, and people just got getting shot out there, like right like 20th. Like I saw a drive by on 20th. On 20th Street, you know, like right outside that bakery over there. And I mean, it was brutal. Like people were dying. And it's like, you know, and
now
you
it's
know,
like,
we're kind of caught right in between that space. And it was like a pretty gnarly neighborhood. And like, you know, like all the, you know, it's like the 19th Street. Serena, we're hanging out like in that park right there.
Right.
And, you know, that's nice, a nice park now. But they were just like hanging out there a lot. And just, you know, like whatever, so it was kind of gnarly down there, and you know, and you know, they just thought it was like once while he'd bring some of his guys and say, look what these people are doing in here, and it was just like kind of thing. It's like a Japanese, these Japanese guys came in there one day, took a lot of pictures, whatever, tourists take a lot of pictures. We ended up in a magazine, like they wrote about us in a magazine. It was like there's this place in San Francisco where people, like, you know, say horrible things about themselves and their families. And you know, they just get up there on the microphone and tell how bad their family was. And that was it was like this shock article of like, can you imagine like these people like just getting up in front of and telling everyone how horrible you are.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it was like this self-deprecating thing. It was pretty, pretty fun. But yeah, it was like that whole thing was this Kinski thing where, like, you know, it was just like these people who were maybe good at one thing but had no life skills for the rest of it. And I loved that. I loved getting the crazy homeless guys in there. Like, some of them could really write, you know, but they, you know, literally lived on the streets and could not keep it together. And it was a lot of just tons of drug addicts, there was a lot of meth around that scene at the time, a lot of meth, and it was really bad too. It was like, and I know a lot of people are like, what's the difference between good meth and bad meth or whatever, but it's just like a whole different nightmare. Like, you know, where you're just like, you're just trying to stay right, and it's bad, it's fucking horrible. Like, you know, it's just this place of darkness, and they'd, you know, write these poems and come out. And by the time the slam scene was in there in the late 90s, it was all kind of like nice, neat and posh, and there was a lot of weed smoking, but like, you know, like
people
had families and friends, they were like MFAs and stuff, and I'm just like,
people don't realize what San Francisco was like in the late 80s, early
90s. It was just like a place where, like, you know, people would end up and you didn't need a car, and it was real cheap, and like in the Mission, it was like the 3-bedroom flat would go for about $800 or $900. And so you could live there on like your GA check or your SSI or whatever and get by. Everything was all right.
Yeah.
You know, you could live in your own apartment back then.
It'd be like Max and Crumb and just, you know, chilling or whatever.
Yeah.
I looked at an apartment on 15th and Mission in 1997. It was a 4-bedroom Victorian, and it was $575 a month for the entire place.
Yeah.
And we were like, no fucking way. We went to walk through it, and I was like, I want to leave now. Like, it was like, you know, 15th admission in 97. So it was
So it was just, you know, I don't know, man. Like that whole thing, like,
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, yeah.
Or both of you. Does Kinski seem like his mania is completely just, is there a drug aspect to it or a mental health aspect to it? What is going on with him?
I mean, hard to tell. It's definitely like a mental problem that he had, you know? And it's just, there's,
looks like he tried to commit suicide around the time he was living with Herzog when he was a kid.
And yeah, you know, and I don't know well enough to diagnose him, but I've just seen that a lot in other people, and just seen the mania, you know, it's just like where...
Egomania, like, I think he's...
You know, you get... Well, you just get, you know, when you get angry, there's no, like, there's just 1 in 10. There's no mid-range emotions, right?
Yeah.
So he gets angry, and it's just at 10. It's not, he's not a little angry at anything. He can't. Like, he's only maximum angry, and it's like, and there's no stopping it.
Yeah.
There's like that rage. It's like that incessant rage. It just, it won't stop until you think, and it's, like it's really rough, and I've seen a lot of people self-medicate off that over the years, and it just, you know, it's like you're taking drugs just to kind of keep your emotions in check. And I did a little bit of that, you know, like, well, I mean, that's what I was primarily doing, but I didn't have it that bad as those people. And I just saw it just like, yeah, this guy cannot fit in society, and he can't, there's this thing. And it's just like, he's fine until something upsets the way things should be. And it's like, it's when you get in a state like that, it's almost like you're outside yourself watching it happen.
Yeah.
And you want someone to stop it. You really want someone to stop it, and no one will. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you just stand there on the street corner, you see the people just like yelling at traffic, and it's like they want someone to stop it. And no one's going to.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know what's going on in their brain. I'm not going to stop it either.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not doing it. Like, you know,
you're not
like
a social worker or anything.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, and it's a painful place to be. And I think that's where he lived a lot, where it's just like he didn't like his just things like would affect him, and he had like so little control over his own emotional states. Yeah. I think that's where it was. I'm not sure. I do know, I mean, he had a lot of talent, and he was able to memorize large chunks of things, and he's able to show up places on time.
Yeah.
But he has expectations that are unrealistic of those places. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. And it's like, you know, even in this film, he's talking about like when he shows up, he's got all this like gear with him and stuff. And it's like,
tons.
That's not how it works.
Yeah.
But it's like, he's just seems to think it's going to be a certain way. And that's what makes him so upset when it's not, you know, and it's just not this, it's this thing about confusion. I have a little bit of that too. Like sometimes I don't understand like what people are saying to me, and it makes me upset, and I have learned tools to deal with that now.
Yeah.
But my old tool is like, you don't understand what this guy's saying, just tell him to fuck off.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Or you get upset or anxious. And, yeah.
Like where it's just like, you know, where like, I have, you know, I have a lot of trouble with like, you know, places I haven't been and menus I haven't seen, things like that. Like little things, the little things.
Oh, Then moving to a new city must be crazy.
Yeah. And it's a little difficult. And it's like, you know, it's why like I'll still go to like a Starbucks, because it's like, I know what they have there.
Yeah.
I know what the menu's like. Right. Yeah. And it's like, maybe if I go in your little like indie coffee shop, And I ask for an espresso over ice, and you say you won't put an espresso over ice because that hurts the espresso, I'm going to get angry. Like, and I have to deal with that. And you know, and instead of like being rational, like I've learned to be rational and be like, okay, I'll have something else, or I'll go somewhere else. You can leave and go somewhere else. That's what I would normally do now. But my impulse is to be like, you know what? Fuck you.
Right.
Like, let's fight over this.
I don't understand this. And I'm,
And it's like that anger. And it's like, I have it like maybe a tenth of what Kinski did.
Right.
And where it's just like, he's just like, let's burn it all down. Let's burn this whole coffee shop down because you don't make my coffee the way you want.
Right.
And it's like, so that's where I kind of feel like a little bit of like, okay, I know where he's living. But, you know, I think that like, you know, I've seen his other films, the non-Herzog films.
Right, like he's in Dr. Zhivago. I didn't remember that.
Yeah. And there's these great ones called A Bullet for Your General and A Big Silence or The Grand Silence, depending on the translation.
Oh, his spaghetti western face? He's talking about that a little bit, yeah.
Oh, they're good.
Yeah, he's got a great
face. They're really good. But you can see him in these films just get away from the director.
Yeah.
And just, like, they're just kind of leaving the camera on while he's like flailing around. Herzog's the only one who can kind of contain it. But it's also kind of what they're paying him for. There's a really bad movie he's in called Venom, where it's basically, okay, here's what Venom's about. This kid orders like a garden snake or something from a pet store, like at this like kind of harmless snake, and they send him this like South African mamba snake or something. This like really deadly. Whoops, we made one of the most venomous snakes in the world. And it gets out right about the time that Kinski and his crew are robbing the house. So they rob the house, but then there's a poisonous snake in the house that's going around taking them all out one by one. It's a horrible film. It looks like the snake looks like a broomstick painted like a snake.
Yeah.
And they're just hitting people with it. And it's really bad. But you see this Kinski had these moments where it's just like, oh, he's doing whatever he wants.
Right.
He's not even, are these even lines from the film? I think he's just ranting at the camera. I think he's having a meltdown right now, and he's just yelling, and they're keeping it in there. I think they're overdubbing his dialogue onto this rant, and it's kind of like, oh, yeah, he just could, you know, whatever. Yeah. Like, that's how you see him in a lot of other things. And I think Herzog was somehow able to take him out of that state, and I think that's why he liked working with him. It's like, oh, he'll keep me from going that far.
Yeah.
I'll still have my chamber, but he'll stop it. That is my point.
Well, and it's like it's like a study in dominance, submission, and chaos. And like, like chaos kind of lives in between those two things. Like when you're trying to obtain dominance over someone, you want them to submit, and like you just create a bunch of chaos in order to get to that submission.
Yeah, it's like the master, but or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And then, like, you see Kinski, obviously, well, they keep talking about intuition this entire documentary. Like, Kinski's intuition, like, what he knew, how to use it, like, he would just feel. But then they also show it one, maybe one of my favorite scenes in this doc is the technique of the turn.
The turn thing,
the turn into the camera, you know, and they show it, and it's like, oh, wow, that is that. Like, that's a famous move that I didn't realize
that he
was a move.
Invented.
So, like, he had that about him as well, was his technique, you know? But, like, that's awesome, man.
Yeah. You know, I think there's a lot of people, like, I'm trying to, like, with my art and all the creativity, I'm trying to find my place in the world. I'm trying to understand where I live and like, how am I supposed to relate to other people? How am I supposed to get along with these people now? How do I atone for what I've done? You know what I mean? That kind of thing. And, you know, I see a lot of that in Kinski. He's like trying to find his place in the world, but it's like his value as an actor gives him worth. And like this film is like a fake reality that he can live in. Right. Mm-hmm. And like, my last therapist in Oakland, because I told him I was more comfortable on stage than I was in one-on-one, just therapy? In any kind of thing. It's like, I hate being in a crowd unless I get to speak to them. Unless you give me a microphone, then I'm fine. Otherwise, I hate being in it. And, you know, I'll stand next to the door. You'll see me in a lot of places. I'll stand right next to the door. Mm-hmm. Like, it's almost this panic thing in case things I forgot, I can get out first.
Yeah. The literal doorman. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. You know, he's like, can I come see you? And I was like,
whoa.
You know, and I was like, yeah, sure. So, and, you know, I joke about my act that it was like to make sure I was actually doing comedy shows and not just like for like cardboard cutouts in my basement. Like,
Rupert Pupkin.
Yeah, Rupert Pupkin. And he came and he explained it. And I wish I just recorded what he said to me in our next session. He's like, you know, comedy for you is a conversation in which you have all the control.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that's why you don't like, you don't understand what other people are saying to you. Like, you don't understand, like, when it's your turn to talk, how loud or how quietly you're talking. You know, you don't understand if, like, you know, they're interested in what you're saying or if you're allowed to change the subject. These are all things that make you uncomfortable, and you have control over all of them in stand up.
Interesting.
And I was like, oh, and just like, I still get like a little like goosebumps thinking of it. He just explained to me, just like, it's like, here's all the things you don't like about being in public and talking to other people, and here's what you love about public speaking, because it's the opposite, because now you have control over all this stuff, and you're just like, it's this, you love the contact with people, you really do love the contact with people, but now you have control over the contact. And I think that's kind of where Kinski was with this thing. It's like, I don't understand where I exist in the world, but I know exactly where to stand in front of the camera. I know exactly where. This would be the best way for people to see things. This is how I see the world. Everything should be seen like this. Yeah. No one else sees it like, but now I can recreate how I see the world through this camera and how I stand in front of it and how I act and all that stuff. And I think that's where he was trying to go all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, that to me is like what's led a lot of my creativity. It's like, here's how I saw a thing. I wrote that novel Black Hole, which is like a lot about the, it's a science fiction novel set entirely in the Mission in the Tenderloin. And it's like, this is how I saw shit. This is how I saw everything. And people were like, where do you get the ideas from? I was like, this is how I saw everything that I saw. Like, this is my interpretation of everything I lived through. It's not what happened. There's a difference. This is my interpretation of it. This is like how it appeared to me that, you know, that I was time traveling back and forth like a week or two at a time constantly. That's how it felt to me. That's not what happened. That's how it felt. So that's how you get to interpret things. I think that's what Kinski was doing in his acting. It's just like, I am interpreting like how I see the world, like through this, not how the world is, but I just want to show you how I see it, because this is constantly like what I'm feeling. You know?
It seems like watching him, it's just like, he seems like a rich tapestry of defense mechanisms, you know, like Klaus Kinski. It's just like, he's just like, I just need to have control of this situation, because I wonder if there's some PTSD involved.
Oh yeah, the war.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's just a more like I mean, he grew up in a German home like that was like not. I mean, all we know is, I can't trust anything from his memoir, but he grew up in a horrible time in Germany, and then he gets drafted into the German army, and it's just a lot of things outside of his control that like. You know, the first time he gets any control over his life whatsoever is when he enters the theater. As far as I see it, that's what happens. And he's, you know, and if you look at his list of things, you see the list of movies and you're like, holy cats, like how many movies this guy was in? He was constantly working.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he's also doing his theater and his one-man tours. And it's like, that's like, it's because it's the only thing that gives you relief from your life.
I mean,
you
know? I'm looking at Wikipedia right now, and that sort of speaks to something you were saying, because there's like also this accusation from his daughter. I mean, his most famous daughter, Natasha Kinski. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
His daughter, Cat People, and all that stuff.
Cat People is awesome.
Yeah,
she's
but
so hot.
One of his daughters accused him of molesting her, and so then like if there is some kind of trauma that could go all the way back there. That could be a manifestation of that. It's sort of like, it's Wikipedia, you know? Yeah, so what can you say about it?
In his memoir, he talks about how sexually attracted Natasha was to him. And
very Trump-like. Very Trumpian.
That's what I was making.
And just like,
yes,
like
that's where I was trying to go with the Dominus
thing. Natasha was like, you're a horrible man. Like,
yeah, she didn't go to the funeral. Only his son went to the funeral.
Yeah. And, you know, she's like, that is not the case. And that's what she was too for. It's like, you don't say that kind of thing about me. But it's like, you can't. It's also not like a suable thing. You can't it's just like, you can't. Like, so she ended up dropping a case. But he said horrible things about her. Like, I'm not like sugarcoating that dude at all. Like, I mean, he's that book crosses the line a lot of times. It's kind of hilarious most of the time, but it gets real dark and weird. And, you know, like, that's,
Well, this isn't a straight biography of Kinski. It's really about the professional relationship or the professional relationship.
Oh, my
relationship. But it is.
So it doesn't touch on any of these controversies.
Buttons? It was like this circle of them pushing each other's buttons.
It's really, you say the thing about control. One
of my favorite parts of the film is when Herzog is talking about, because on the set of Fitzcarraldo, the people playing the natives, right?
Featured extras, I guess.
Totally. They were like, you know, we can kill Kinski for you and put him in bury him in the jungle where no one will ever find him.
Yeah,
and his response is like, I might need him for another film, like, you know, but it's this thing like too where like, oh yeah, there's a thing where he's like Kinski's having a tantrum, and so Herzog's answer is to go find this chocolate bar he's hidden for months, and he goes out there and just slowly eats it in front of Kinski while Kinski's like freaking out,
yeah,
And it stops Kenshin in his tracks. Oh, yeah. He doesn't know what to do. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, they did push each other's buttons. They did know. And it's just like, and the natives did say, it's just like the whole time that he was having these tantrums, we weren't scared of him. We were scared of you because you didn't react.
Right. That's what I was saying. And, like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like this thing of like, yeah, of like he kind of, in some way, Kinski's like having his tantrum, but also like Herdsar's also kind of showing off in front of everyone else.
Right. Right.
Where just like, mm-hmm. oh, yeah, you guys are freedom, but I love this. This is chaos.
Yeah.
It's normal for me.
Yeah.
You know, you don't understand.
Too chaotic. You know, like,
yeah. Like, you know, it's shocking for some, but to me, it's normal. Well, I once saw him destroy a bathroom so thoroughly, he could sift it with a tennis racket. It's like, how many times do you think Herzog has told the tennis racket story? Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, that's something he's like, his close friends are probably sick of.
I took a film history course in college, and it was the first time we watched Aguirre, and it was phenomenal. My professor was a huge Werner Herzog fan, and we broke that shit down. So the first story he told though was
the panning shot. Yeah. Is that shot where you're not going to see you in it? He's like, well, I'm not going to be in it.
Yeah,
that one.
But the moment he talked about was when Herzog pointed the gun.
Oh.
At Kinski.
Right.
Because Kinski was like, I'm gone. Auf Wiedersehen. And you know, famously, Herzog points a gun at him.
Right.
And he was like, I'll just shoot you if you don't come back.
Or what he threatens is like, there will be 8 bullets in your head. Mine will be the 9th.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to shoot you when you're dead, motherfucker.
Yeah.
Like, basically.
Yeah. There is a, there are commentary tracks on Aguirre and it's brilliant. Shout Factory.
Wait.
Like, I'm not paid by Shout Factory, but they have released a set of the Herzog collection, and they're
with
amazing.
The
they're beautiful prints,
really
beautiful things, mm-hmm. and the commentary tracks are amazing. Mm-hmm. And there's one thing right at the end of Aguirre when it's just like Aguirre in the raft of monkeys.
Yeah, the monkeys.
And you know, Herzog, like Kinski, picks one up and stares at it,
I
and then throws it into
monkey.
The river.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're worried about the monkey, but it's just like there's this long pause. There's this long pause, and then Herzog breaks in and goes, no one could throw a monkey like Kinski. And it's like, this is the thing. This is also the great thing about this, about My Best Fiend, is because it sets up this relationship. And then you can go back and you can watch Aguirre with the commentary
knowing
track
it,
on.
Yeah.
And he's just like, just talking like scene by scene what Kinski's doing, what happened before. So it's just like, this is just like, this documentary is like the gateway into a really deep Herzog hole.
Yeah.
You can go down to, like, not only do you watch the films, watch them with the commentary tracks on. Mm-hmm. And I actually recommend the commentary tracks for the early films, like Evador Started Small and like Hearts of Glass and stuff like that. It's actually like really helpful to help you understand what's going on.
I watched this on DVD. There was not any audio commentary track for this, unfortunately.
Yeah. Shout Factory, like, I got their Blu-ray set. It's worth the money.
Mm-hmm.
I just mentioned them by name because they are doing, they do their DVD collections right.
Mm-hmm.
When they put something out, it's amazing. It's everything you want on there. I mean, I also, another thing I have from there, I have the Decline set from there.
I have the Decline set right up there, yeah.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's got so much great stuff on there.
Yeah, the booklets.
Like, so many great extras. Like, you see the Decline 1 extras where it's just like Penelope, like Spheres, like talking about all these panel discussions, all these great things, all these outtakes, all the footage. It's brilliant, and it's like, okay, there's still, like...
Are they Rhino? Is that Rhino part of... Is Shout Factory a subsidiary?
I don't know.
Okay, yeah.
I don't know about that, but I do know it's just like they are still putting films together for people who love films.
Mm-hmm.
And in this kind of streaming episode culture that we're in, like, we're kind of losing a lot of that.
He was a magnificent actor, and he had this capacity of transformation that I love. He was very difficult. I remember when I was supposed to do the film with you, all the people, actors and actresses, they said to me, my God, you're going to work with Klaus. He's impossible to work with. He's totally crazy.
Yeah. And you know, it's like I'm always, I hope it comes back as a cycle where people start to love films again. But, you know, it's like, you know, people will not watch them, but they'll watch like 6 hours of a TV show in like a day, but they will not watch a film, and it's like they don't care about the quality or the sound quality. And it's like, I got these things on Blu-ray. They're brilliant. And if you see Aguirre like on a big screen, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And you never seen anything quite
the
like it.
The pacing in itself.
Yeah. But even that, like, people won't sit still for it now. And it's just like too slow and plotting and whatever. And it's like, you know, so anyone out there, like, I would recommend looking on Shout Factory's website. Mm-hmm. They stream a lot of their stuff, and they will stream. Sometimes they will stream things with a commentary track.
Oh, okay.
You might be able to find it that way.
Oh, awesome!
They have a nice option where you can either watch a commercial free for $1, or you can just like watch it for free, and there's going to be a commercial break every once in a while. But they have a lot of stuff that they. I have there on my Roku box. I have the Shout channel. They have a channel.
Oh, whoa!
Where you can just watch stuff on your thing, and so you can watch these little biker films and stuff. Like,
that's awesome.
Like Shout Factory doesn't have a whole lot of streaming, but it's highly curated. It's like stuff that they sell on Blu-ray.
Okay,
so you can like be like, okay, this is kind of cool. I want to go deeper, and like you can buy stuff. It's a really great. I love their business model. I love what they're doing.
That's cool.
And they are catering to movie nerds and not just like people who like to, you know, binge watch a show and complain about it, you know.
Well, and I'm checking, and I just see that there is a way to stream My Best Fiend on Shout Factory's website, because I had to dig up a DVD copy of this. This is not streaming any other
podcast. Yeah,
so that we can send people, we can put this link in the episode.
And what's I just realized too is that Kidinsky lived in San Francisco or north of San Francisco.
Dies in Lagunitas or something.
So there was a chance maybe you crossed paths and didn't know. when you were living there. And Herzog lives here in Los Angeles.
Yeah, you remember when Herzog got shot during an interview and just kept talking?
Yeah.
No.
It's not
the
much.
Pellet gun or something. Yeah. He's like, it's a wound, never mind, let's continue.
He's being prolific right now. Lo and behold, and then that Volcanoes one.
Totally. Like, Cave of Forgotten Dreams and like all these things. Yeah. And he cranks out a bunch, and I just think it's because like he's kind of built his brand right now. He's in the thing, like I said, where it's like almost like,
He could just do voiceover work. And
it's also like, you know, basically if you have the money and you can do things quickly, he'll work with you. Like,
lo and behold is like,
it's pretty patched.
Produced by like a technology company.
Where they're just like probably approached him like, hey, can you do
branded
this thing
content.
For us? Like, can you be a spokesperson for this documentary? And they're like, sure. Like, here, you know, and it's just like, that's where he's at now. And, there's these various phases of his career, you know, and it's like you kind of pick your favorite one and live in it, you know.
It's like
Star Trek or something. And it's like, some people like The Next Generation better.
Right.
Like, people like the original series. And, you know, it's like, what do you like? Because it's this whole world. Yeah. It's like, you know, I've read some of the books. You know, I've read all his interviews. Uh-huh. Like, you know, the Fitzcarraldo journals are amazing. Like, you know, where he's just like,
that tiny writing he did and the tiny booklet. Remember, there's a part where, like, Herzog's writing, like, microscopically.
I don't know him. I never met him. I never worked with him.
Nice to meet you.
How are you?
Have you met before?
No, they've just met.
Only on the battlefield. On the battlefield of life itself.
He's crazy. It's crazy. That's why we work together. Otherwise, we would never do anything together.
Oh, But it's like this whole, book, just like the journals he kept on making Fitzcarraldo, and it's fantastic. And he just talks these things, and just like you get to see all these sides of things. Like, you know, Kinski shows up with a 600-page script about Paganini. Going on and on about that, like, you know, it's like how, you know, like just all these kind of things like that where you're just like, oh, it's just each more is a little tidbit.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And you kind of put the documentary together with the book and this interview, and then you start to get this whole picture of what's happening.
It almost reminds me, I mean, did you see that Kubrick exhibit when it came through? There was one, it was at LACMA.
No,
and there was
I didn't see that one.
Like, because there's like notes of all like the movies that he didn't make. He's got the actual like, marginalia in like his copy of The Shining of like things to change.
It was a great exhibit.
Like all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Just circling back to this idea of how this movie exists and this idea that like these guys were like basically kind of like super frenemies. I don't know of a better way to think about it.
Yeah.
But like the idea then like one of them gets to kind of have the last the last word making the documentary about the other guy. It's like it kind of like that also seems like I'm like, was do you think Kinski could be like, this asshole gets to have the final say? But then they really were better friends than it was like both. It was like everything. It was like
the end. He shows him being super playful.
Oh yeah, like know, it's that, really like a nice.
I think
nice
like overall,
spin
like
on it.
Like in the moment, Kinski would have his tantrums, but like kind of like I was saying is just that like. Like, because Herzog could kind of contain his tantrums, and that's what made him love Herzog, right? Because it's like this only guy who can keep this to a certain level. I'll be okay. I can express this. I can have the tantrum because, you know, Herzog will keep me from literally killing people. Which is just like maybe he's like Kinski's like afraid of himself and his emotions most of the time because
he calls
can't
him a coward, doesn't he? Doesn't like Herzog call him a coward? He's like the only thing as good as that. Like sometimes he's too afraid to actually do.
Totally. And it's just like he's kind of afraid of I think of his emotions and where they take him. And you know he knows like that Kinski can kind of like that Herzog can control him and cage him in a certain way. And that's what he's been looking for, you know? And that's you know, like this is like, you know, it's just so everybody else on there, I don't care who it knows, but I'm a recovering drug addict myself. And that's like, you know, I've seen that quite a bit where it's just like, you know, like people want to turn their minds off, you know, like like the self-medicating thing is like a horrible thing. They don't like, they take the drugs to stop thinking about things, like, you know, and it's like, I've seen that so many times of like we're trying to hide from this thing, you know. It's like very few people go to the extremes to ruin their lives the way drug addicts do without something they're trying to forget and without something they're trying to contain, you know. And just like, you know, and you know, I did like, you know, I had a lot of emotional issues after I quit using like that.
I bet
you know it was really horrible, and you know I had like a teenager's capacity to deal with adult problems,
right? Because that's where your last emotional development was,
and you know that's where I started getting a lot of therapy and stuff and just a lot of 12-step stuff, just because like I didn't know how to deal with stuff. How do you deal with things? Like, what do you like? I can't live this way. It was like the last couple years I was out drinking. I was getting into a lot of fights and stuff, like out on the street, you know, just like out in the, you know, like 17th and Cap, stuff like that. And it's not good. You know, it's like, I know how this ends. I've seen it, you know, like this is not good. And
I've
it's
seen
like,
17th and Cap.
And it's like, you know, and then like, I get sober and it's just like, I still have that anger. Like now I'm not, but where do I put the anger?
Yeah,
like and
damn
it's like,
kettlebell.
Totally. Well, I mean, it's one of the things I started like getting into. You know, a lot of the athleticism and stuff. I started like kind of balancing that need. But you know, it's you know, that's the real tricky part of quitting. It's just like I don't know where to put this now.
Yeah,
like I want to put my anger somewhere and I can't, and you know, or I want to put this like fear somewhere and I can't. Like, you know, like people, like, you know, I would put depression somewhere, but I can't. And that's why people have a hard time quitting. You know, it's like if it wasn't that, detox would work for everyone. All you need to do is detox someone after a couple of days. The physical cravings are gone. Like
but
now,
the mental.
Like, the emotional side is just like, I'm sad. What do I do? I'm sad. Like, I'm like, I want to kill myself sad. What do I do?
Yeah.
Can I just push this button and make it all go away? And I think that's like, you know, where a lot of this was in a lot of the like kind of Kinski moments,
the acting out,
you know, just like I got it, like I need to like exhibit this, but I you know,
someone's got to be.
I hope someone can stop it, before the end, you know, like you know, and I think that's why you just see him like embracing Herzog and other things, just like, you allow me to like go where I need to go, but you won't let me die. You know, like, it's
literally
just that kind of thing. And just like,
I also feel like sometimes bullies, like, he seemed like and bullies like to be told, like, stop. You're not gonna bully me. I'm not afraid of you.
Or like the biggest bully is that way because of insecurity.
It's all defense mechanisms. And it's like, I've known so many bullies in my life, and I'm always like, I don't care. I'm not afraid of you. And then they're like, you're my best friend now.
Right. Like, and someone who's as deadpan as Herzog needs to be, like someone who won't react. It's like, oh my God, this guy won't react.
The chocolate bar story. Like, he's like, oh, I'll be right back.
Yeah.
Don't fuck with the German's chocolate.
No. No, if anything.
You know, there's a lot of people who would be like, hey, you know, why don't you go spit off the edge of this cliff? You know, and it's like, oh, well, that it might fall off. And then, but if you know, it's like, I'm going to tether you to this pole. Now go do it. And then you go do it then. Yeah. And, you know, like, still, like, I'd probably be too scared in that situation. Yeah. I don't like the heights that much. But, but like, I think that's kind of what it's like, you know, Herzog was kind of like his tether. And, like, it's like, I want you to go to this edge of madness and insanity. And I want you to go to this thing. And I'll be here. Mm-hmm. I'll be here to keep you from going over the other side. You know, I think that's always, like, a thing. It's just like, there's a kind of horrible part of depression and of anger. Where you think I'm always going to be this way. Like, I've just broken the thing. Insomniacs talk about it a lot, where they're just like, afraid I'm never going to sleep again. It's this real fear of like, I'm afraid I'm always going to be this depressed. I'd just rather kill myself.
Right.
You know, or just like, you know, I'm always going to be this angry. I don't know what to do. And I think, you know, that Herzog kind of helped that fear of his. Like, I want to go to this place to act in this role, but if I do it, I might break the thing. I might be that way forever. And I think I always knew it hurts like that. He'd always pull him back, you know? And it's like, so I can be like at 10, like that's, you know, a gambling addict is not, they don't get a rush from winning unless they're really risking something.
Okay.
Like if they're just like,
I hear that.
A gambling addict can't risk a dollar. They don't care. It almost makes them mad to do that. They have to bet the rent money. They have to do that because that's the only thing that gets them off. And I think that's where Kinski was living artistically, of like, I have to risk my own mental health to do this role. Because otherwise, I'm just not going to, it's not good.
It's not enjoyable.
It's not good. Yeah, I'm not going to get off on it. But it's like, what if the risk fails, you know, and, you know, who's going to save me, you know?
Wow. Well, that's a good, I think that's a great wrap up for this documentary.
Okay. Yeah, I think I can. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. It was like, as you said, I could easily talk about this shit for days. And
it's awesome.
Days,
we're tethering you. We're pulling you back.
Yeah, awesome. Totally. Yeah. Totally.
Well, thank you so much, dude.
Thanks,
this was
Bucky.
Awesome.
Yeah.
This is
totally.
A great film.
Yeah.
Definitely watch it. Get into that rabbit hole.
Yeah. Totally. Like, start here. Start on Grizzly Man.
Yeah.
You know, like, just start somewhere and go find it. Like, you know, shout out to Shout Factory for you know, making this available to a lot of people, and you know, support them. I think, you know, I'm not paid by them in any way. I'm just a strong supporter because they make a great product,
right?
In the way
maybe
that I want
will
to be
get
made.
Paid.
Yeah, totally. Like, contact them. See that they're going to promote this thing. It's like a long commercial for that. For that Herzog collection.
Yeah.
Worth all the money.
I want you to be in a Werner Herzog movie now. I think I
would love
how
that.
How awesome would that be?
That would be good if then this is then the reason for that to happen.
That would
Werner's
be awesome.
Listening.
Let's hope.
If you need a kettlebell.
He could, you know, if he could direct my stand-up tragedy special.
And you can see Bucky every Monday at Little Joy in Echo Park if you're down here at
Los
the business
Angeles.
For free. All right.
Thank you, Bucky.
Thanks a lot, Bucky. Thanks for listening.
You can find more episodes of SupDoc, show notes, updates, and more at supdocpodcast.com.
We are on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SupDocPodcast.
If you have comments, corrections, or want to suggest a documentary, email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
SupDoc is listener supported. You can donate to the show at patreon.com/supdocpodcast.
If you can't donate financially, please subscribe, comment, or tell a friend about SupDoc.
And we'd like to thank Documentary News for their ongoing support. This episode is produced by Kip Yolhorn. Our theme music is by David Siegel.